It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Hunger and food insecurity is worsening in Wisconsin. The struggle to afford groceries is driven by a number of factors.
Inflation has been causing food prices to go up, along with the cost of living.
And now with cuts to federal programs and day 15 of a partial government shutdown, some families are starting to miss paychecks.
This also comes ahead of the holiday season, a time when food banks tend to experience greater demand in the communities they serve.
Here to talk about the situation at food banks is Michelle Orge, President and Executive Director of Second Harvest Food Bank of Southern Wisconsin, and Matt Steenstra, Director of Advocacy and Community Engagement at Feeding America Eastern Wisconsin. Michelle and Matt, welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for having me.
Michelle, let's start with you. What volumes of food are moving through your organization at Second Harvest now, and how does it compare to this time last year?
We're holding pretty steady compared to last year, which is about 2 million pounds a month. But the notable thing is that is higher than the height of the pandemic. I mean, we're edging up a bit each month, but it's not as noticeable as compared to the pandemic. Prior to the pandemic, we were at about 500,000 pounds a month, which we were pretty proud of. And then during the pandemic, it was 1 million pounds a month. And that was surprising to us. Based on our capacity, but not based on the situation we were in with COVID. Now we're twice as much food as we were at the height of the pandemic, and that's pretty significant.
And you have a direct line to food banks in local communities. What are you hearing from the local food banks that you distribute food to?
Yeah, we work with about 300 partners and programs, partner agencies, food pantries, meal programs, mobile pantries, school markets, around our 16 counties. And they are just seeing increases in the number of folks they're seeing, the number of visits, the new folks that are coming for support. And they need more food from us. And it's been challenging to get them everything they need just because of resources that are available to all of us. There's food out there, there's donated food out there, but having the resources to be able to get that to where it needs to go. I mean, we're built for this, but the increases are putting a lot of pressure on folks, the uncertainty, every week there's something, We're used to uncertainty, but the number of things that have been, thrown our way over the past several months have been significant. And, it's even more so for the folks facing food insecurity.
Matt, what does this economic uncertainty look like in your organization? How does food output compare to last year?
Feeding America East Wisconsin represents 35 counties on the eastern part of the state. And over across the entire year, we serve about 500,000 people. Mm-hmm. I'm going to agree with Michelle. We're working to get out millions of pounds of food a month. However, this is the same heightened demand that we've been seeing now since inflation really started kicking up in 2022. There's pockets across our footprint where we're seeing food pantries from Milwaukee to Berlin, Wisconsin, that are saying that they've seen their participation double and then double again. That being said, it's really a struggle for food pantries, not just to figure out how do we make sure that we serve this growing line of people coming through to be able to access food, but how are we making sure that we're giving them food that they can put together to make a meal? So we've seen this dramatic increase in food pantry visitors, but it's been sustained and there's been a strain on the system. And like Michelle said, we're built for moments like this, but we were never meant to be able to have to do this all alone.
Matt, I'm sure you also have an eye on the situation around SNAP benefits, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, the Trump administration warning there could be insufficient funds to pay for full SNAP benefits. What are you seeing and how are you preparing for this?
Our job is to make sure that we're able to help serve our network of 400 food pantries and meal sites. There's no way that we can replace the food share program across the entire state. It serves nearly 700,000 people. And every single month, it's more than $110 million that gets injected into our local grocery stores and retailers. For every one meal we're able to provide, the food share program provides nine. We can't replace that. So what we need to do is to make sure that we're keeping an eye on what's happening both in Washington, D.C. and Madison. And we're making sure that we're working with our partners to deliver like clear, strong, consistent communication to make sure that they're as prepared as they can be. But no food pantry is going to be able to accept and serve all the people that come through their doors if there's no food share benefits in November.
And Michelle, I would imagine Second Harvest is watching this closely as well. I mean, starting November 1st, the federal government is also expanding its work requirements for different assistance programs, including SNAP. And this could, you know, make people ineligible. How do you think these changes could affect demand at the food banks and for your services?
Well, you know, there are so many folks that we support that get that extra supplemental help from WIC, from SNAP, from other benefits that now are going to need more support from us. And the preparing for what is ahead, you know, we don't know exactly what that's going to look like, but we're, you know, with a government shutdown, including the, you know, the employees that may be affected by that looming as well. The you know, their savings are going to be running out if this continues. It's just, you know, there's the term perfect storm gets used a lot. This just seems to be an ongoing storm with this, and it's I keep thinking that we've seen everything and we just keep seeing something new, and we're just bracing for what's coming next.
That is Michelle Orge, President and Executive Director of Second Harvest Food Bank of Southern Wisconsin. Matt Steenstra is with us as well, Director of Advocacy and Community Engagement for Feeding America Eastern Wisconsin. You know, the holidays, Matt, are right around the corner. I would imagine this is traditionally a challenging time for food banks when you see more demand. You know, do you think that that will be the case in the holiday season?
Of course. Every November, it is the, I don't think it's a stretch to say it's the busiest time for food banks. And it's the busiest time for food pantries because families are coming together, looking to put together meals that they can feel proud about, that they can feel good about, that there's emotion and tradition attached to. And we want to make sure that our food pantries have not just food, but the ingredients it takes to be able to make a meal that people can really feel good about. But there's only so much food to go around. And like Michelle said, there's a massive amount of uncertainty right now, and demand is already at an all-time high. What we're seeing is not just an increase in people coming to food pantries, but an increase of new families. A recent study from Feeding America showed that 30% of the people that are coming to food pantries right now don't even qualify for federal benefits. And we're seeing a growing number of people that have jobs, but their incomes are just a little too high to qualify for free school meals or to qualify for food share benefits. So figuring out how to make sure that we're working with food producers, that we're working with our state and federal government to figure out how we can best serve families is going to be really key. And it's a really tight timeline right now.
Michelle, I want to turn to the ingredients themselves and what is on the shelves. Matt talked about having the right ingredients for families to be able to put different, you know, recipes together. Have you had any issues with stocking fresh produce and fresh staples, for instance?
Well, they cost more and that takes resources, right? So the challenge that families face, the challenge is that, I mean, when any of us go to the grocery store, we know that some of the food costs more, and that's often the food that has highly nutritious values. It's the fresh foods, it's the produce. And this is food that everyone wants to feed their family good food. And the challenges that folks face are that the same ones we face is that is some of the most high cost food. And that is our barrier, is getting that food has costs associated with it. We can get it donated, but there's, you know, we have to store it in refrigeration. There's transportation in refrigeration. It has a short shelf life and just the logistics of all of that. And, you know, we're built for this, but it's a lot of logistics, and our partners need to turn this food around really quickly. And having the right mix of it, you know, no matter what anybody believes somebody should be doing or buying or serving their kids. I believe that everybody wants to give their kids good food. It's just a matter of cost. And often the reason why folks are not feeding their families the most nutritious food is because they can't afford it. And we're able to get a lot of local food. You know, there's food banks in Wisconsin, Feeding America Eastern Wisconsin, Second Harvest, the other food banks in Wisconsin. We do a really good job of working with local agriculture, producers, vendors all around the state to make sure we get as much local produce. Because for every dollar we spend on local produce, it's like $1.60 in local economic activity. And that's important to us, supporting local agriculture.
And Matt, you know, you obviously have different contracts than someone going through the grocery store line and paying at checkout. But has inflation been challenging for what you can keep in stock and distribute to food banks?
Absolutely. Inflation hits everything across the board, from the food that we go out and source to the boxes that help make sure that the food gets to families at a maybe mobile pop-up pantry, to the trucking costs of delivering the food up to the northern Wisconsin counties or down to Racine. Across the board, inflation hits us at every single line item in the budget, which is why we work really hard to build strong relationships with the community to make sure that we communicate the challenges that we face, the what's at stake, and how everyone coming together can be part of the solution.
Well, Matt and Michelle, thank you so much for the update. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much.
Matt Steenstra is with Feeding America Eastern Wisconsin. Michelle Orge leads Second Harvest Food Bank of Southern Wisconsin. And for disclosure, Second Harvest is a business sponsor of WPR. We've been checking in on food insecurity and what food banks are experiencing during the government shutdown and how they'll prepare for demands in the upcoming holiday season.
Coming up, foreign language programs in Wisconsin face funding challenges. Two language instructors share the value of learning a second language for students and the wider community.
It's very important for our economic competitiveness in this state and in this nation for us to have people with that high level of language proficiency.
That's next on Wisconsin Today. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. For many students, language learning is a big part of their education. In high school, you might take classes in Spanish or French, maybe German.
At the college level, the choices open up even more. Across the system, the universities of Wisconsin offer more than 60 languages, including Norwegian, Hmong, and Ojibwe, all of which are significant to heritage and immigrant populations in the state.
But language programs at Wisconsin colleges and universities are facing an uphill battle with federal funding cuts and changing state budget priorities.
At the start of the school year, the Trump administration canceled foreign language and area studies grants, leaving more than 50 students in Wisconsin without financial support they were counting on for their studies.
Now, campus leaders across the UW system are working to find a way forward for language learning programs, and later we'll hear from a language educator in Eau Claire.
But first, Francis Vavris is vice provost and dean of the International Division at UW-Madison. Francis, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you very much for having me.
We've been seeing funding cuts lately to university language programs from the federal level, including the cancellation of this Foreign Language and Area Studies Fellowship program. What does this mean for students in Wisconsin right now?
Thank you for the question, Rob. Yes, so the Foreign Language and Area Studies Fellowships, or FLAS Fellowships, are part of what is known as the Title VI program. So the Title VI program funds students to study less commonly taught languages, and it also funds our national resource centers. We have 8 national resource centers at the University of Wisconsin-Madison that provide all kinds of language-related and area studies-related programming for students on our campus and for K-14 schools across the state. So with the loss of Title VI funding, we wrote a reconsideration letter in the middle of September when we first learned of the non-continuation of the Title VI grants. And unfortunately, last week, we learned that our reconsideration request was denied. So we are now operating in an environment where we need to consider how we will keep our commitment to foreign language instruction and area studies going on our campus and across the United States. On our campus, 54 students were slated to receive foreign language and area studies fellowships. And unfortunately, then they will not have the opportunity to study those languages with the scholarship support that often is necessary to make that a possibility for students. That doesn't mean that they will not pursue those languages, but we do know that some students have faced very tough decisions about what they will study and whether they can continue in their studies without the scholarship.
I want to talk about the why of funding foreign languages. The foreign language and area studies fellowships we're talking about, they used to be called, I guess, before the 1970s, the National Defense Foreign Language Fellowships. The idea that there is a national security interest in having Americans who can speak the languages that people speak around the world. Talk a little bit about the value, please, of having people know how to talk different languages, national security or otherwise.
Absolutely, Rob. So these programs came out of a particular moment, the launching of Sputnik in 1957. And so Title VI refers to part of the 1965 Higher Education Act, and that was designed to support foreign language and area studies for the defense of this country. So when I think about the importance of continuing with Title VI programming, defense and diplomacy certainly are very important objectives of these programs. We have graduates who receive FLAS fellowships and who have taken our area studies courses, who go on to work in consular offices, who work in the Department of State, who work in the Department of Defense, and so forth. So these continue to be very important programs for both defense and democracy and diplomacy. So we think that these do meet national interests. We also feel that they're very important to remain economically competitive. We have a state economy that's deeply integrated into the global economy. And so for our businesses to have multilingual employees, people who can speak languages where their companies are based, or to be part of multilingual teams, to have the kind of deep intercultural competence that's necessary to advance economic objectives, we see this also as part of the goals of the Title VI program and one of the reasons why we hope that they will continue. And then a final reason, I think, for these programs is the educational opportunities that studying foreign language provides. We have more than 470,000 people in the state of Wisconsin who speak a language other than English in their home. There are about 100 different languages spoken in the state of Wisconsin. And so when these children come to our schools, it's very beneficial if their teachers have had opportunities to study another language so they can understand, you know, the challenges and the benefits of developing multilingualism. There's also, I think, a deep satisfaction in learning another language. It develops critical thinking. And so we hope that these programs would continue for educational reasons as well.
UW-Madison, I think in particular, is known for having a lot of programs in less commonly taught languages. There's an abbreviation, LCTLs. What kind of languages fall under this umbrella, and what do you see as the value of focusing on them?
Very good question. So less commonly taught languages, or LCTLs, as they are often known, are less commonly taught in U.S. schools, but they are very widely spoken languages. And this is sometimes a misconception about the languages. So a less commonly taught language in the United States is Arabic, which is spoken by more than 400 million people around the world. Hindi is another one, spoken by 345 million plus people. And Portuguese is also considered a less commonly taught language, spoken by about 250 million people around the world. So less commonly taught does not mean less widely spoken. One of the reasons why we want to advance the study of LICTLs on our campus is that there are not as many opportunities for students in the United States, both at the K-12 level and at the university level, to study these languages. And the University of Wisconsin-Madison, as you rightly pointed out, has long been a place where people can come from around the country or around the world to study these languages. And one of our programs related to LICTLs is a Department of Defense program called the Language Flagships. So the Department of Defense funds these programs, and these students study in this Wisconsin Summer Language Institute, and then they go overseas and do further study. So by the end of the time in Wisconsin and then overseas, these are highly proficient language speakers.
People, policymakers, taxpayers, whoever might look and say, yeah, these programs are great for the student, right, who receives this funding. What's in it for us? How do you see these things spilling over and benefiting a broader Wisconsin community off campus?
Absolutely. I mean, I could take simply the economic competitiveness point. Wisconsin, I think, in 2024 had about $27 billion in exports. Our major trading partners, Mexico, China, Germany, Australia, and Canada, and arguably you can get by pretty well in most of Canada, though not all of Canada in English, Mexico, China, Germany, and the many other countries with whom we trade do not have English as the primary language. I often hear people say, but English is spoken all around the world. And it's true that it is a primary second language, but only about 15% of the world's population speaks English at a highly proficient level. Most people speak it, you know, at the way that perhaps I might speak German at this point. I can get by, but I certainly would not be able to negotiate a trade agreement in that language. So it's very important for our economic competitiveness in this state and in this nation for us to have people with that high level of language proficiency. That is, I think, one of the important reasons for continuing to support these languages. I also think that we need to recognize that the state of Wisconsin has always been and continues to be a very diverse state. I was looking up some information. I saw that in 1910, 25% of the residents of the state of Wisconsin spoke German and spoke only German. Our primary languages other than English are Hmong, Spanish, and German. So we have many speakers of languages other than English, or they are bilingual or multilingual speakers. And I think it's important for us to serve those residents as well as monolingual English speakers in this state. And that means having doctors, having teachers, having social workers, having people that we interact with on a regular basis, whether they're police officers, firefighters, who have multilingual competence. Certainly, they cannot know all the languages in the state, but for us to be able to have someone, let's say, in a hospital who could translate for a new arrival, an immigrant or refugee, or someone who's recently moved to the state who is not yet proficient in English, serves all of us very well.
As we wrap up, I think sometimes language instruction may be seen as an elective or an optional thing. Can you make the case for keeping it at the core of our education?
Well, I can speak perhaps from a personal example. I grew up in a family. My father was an immigrant. English was his third language. He became a linguistics professor and taught Russian. My mother grew up in the United States, but she learned Spanish and she became a Spanish teacher. So I was raised in that kind of family where it was assumed that we would learn a second language at some point. So it has always been, in my view, part of a well-rounded education. If we are going to be a world-class university, if we're going to be a state that promotes a world-class education for our K-12 students, then we need to be preparing students to engage in the world within the boundaries of the United States that is increasingly multilingual, and for the world outside of our borders where most people do speak more than one language. So I see it as very important for kind of equating a quality education and a world-class education with language instruction.
Fran, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Okay, thank you so much, Rob. Enjoy the rest of your day.
That was Frances Vavras, Vice Provost and Dean of the International Division at UW-Madison. We've been talking about the impact of funding cuts on language programs around the state and what those programs mean for their local communities. Now we head over to see how this is affecting students and the community in western Wisconsin. Kaishan Kong is Professor of Chinese Language and Culture and Second Language Acquisition at UW-Eau Claire. Kaishan, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
As we've been hearing, we've got these federal funding cuts to different language programs. How are you feeling that impact at UW-Eau Claire?
That's a very good question. Yes. So on September 10th, many of the language instructors, educators know that the U.S. Department of Education announced the discontinuation of some of the funding for language-related programs. And as a language instructor and educator, I feel very sad to see that because I think discontinuing funding for language-related programs really significantly reduced the transformative professional learning opportunities for language instructors and also future language educators. And I think other ripple effects would be seeing language programs being reduced and our class size cap being increased. And it's sad to see language programs more and more being considered as extra service program for others, while in reality, we are providing high impact learning.
Can you talk about the impact of that learning? How do programs in, say, Chinese and other languages at UW-Eau Claire benefit the wider community in, say, western Wisconsin?
I think in some people's mind, there is a misconception that language learning is like something you can do to fill your schedule or something extra, but we are really providing high impact learning and serving the wider community. So for instance, our students from our language program in Eau Claire, our students are active and engaged participants in community service, such as translation, interpretation at different settings like court, schools, healthcare facilities. And we also are a huge producer of local K-12 schools language teachers. And some of our alumni are stellar and well-known nationally award-winning teachers in our local school. They were our alumni. We also provide bilingual summer camp for our young kids, young learners in Eau Claire and wider community. So we're helping to produce the next generation of multilingual learners.
I wanted to ask about Chinese language education in particular. It's not one of the more commonly taught languages in the U.S., say, at the high school level, but just Mandarin Chinese, I was looking at the chart, it's the number one most spoken first language in the world. Throw in other varieties of the Chinese language, you're up well over a billion people speaking these things. Tell us a little bit about what you see as the value of having Chinese language education available for students in Wisconsin.
Absolutely. And I think you had a good point. There is such a large population of people speaking Chinese. Like basically wherever you go in the world, you have a big chance of meeting someone who speaks Chinese, Mandarin or Cantonese or other dialects. And I think firstly, it's a very cool thing for students to do. So I always tell students, if you learn the Mandarin, may not be the easiest language to learn, but you're the coolest person on your block. How many of you can do that? So I think wherever you travel, you have a chance of knowing people that you normally would not know if you travel to other places if you do not speak the language. Like you can get to know the nuances and the culture. You can really improve the cultural empathy and really get to know people, go beyond learning from the textbook, go beyond the tourist asking for direction. If you know the language, you have the cultural curiosity. And so in our Chinese language program, although Eau Claire Chinese program is only a certificate, our students are really doing incredible work to go beyond the classroom. And our Eau Claire also has a large number of Chinese international students, and we have some scholars as well. So in our program, we really just not only teach the language, but also our students, local Eau Claire students, become natural bridges to connect these international students and scholars from China or Chinese-speaking regions to the local Eau Claire community. So they can have events together, they can communicate, they can learn from each other's culture. So I think that's also another example to show how Chinese program is serving the community. And our students in the past helped local tour agencies translate traveling brochures to make them multilingual. And we offer Lunar New Year celebrations for our local communities too.
You mentioned earlier your concern that people might see foreign language education, maybe study abroad programs, as an extra or a luxury or something like that. As we wrap up, make the case for the importance of these programs, of making language learning available to people in Wisconsin.
Right. And thank you for giving me the chance to give a counter argument, because I absolutely argue that language and study abroad programs are not luxuries or extra programs, because we are providing high impact learning, because the world develops regardless whether we participate or not. I really think we should prepare and engage our students to dive in, to engage in this global development. When students go beyond bubbles, they will see that the world is more complex than what they learn from the textbook. And let's not forget, Eau Claire is one of the top producers of Fulbright student assistants in the country. And I think it reflects our record of excellent work in producing multilingual and multicultural learners. So I think we should definitely continue and improve the language and study abroad programs.
Kaishan, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Kaishan Kong is professor of Chinese language and culture and second language acquisition at UW-Eau Claire. We also heard from Francis Vavris, vice provost and dean of the international division at UW-Madison, been talking about challenges faced by language programs at the universities of Wisconsin and beyond in the wake of federal funding cuts.
Up, what it's like to bike around Lake Michigan over 1,000 miles and to complete the journey.
Setting the goal, achieving that goal, getting through those hard days, and knowing now that I can do it.
Around Lake Michigan in 8 days, that's next on WPR News. You're listening to Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. It's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a group of walkers on a mission.
The Madison Methodical Meanderers has a goal. The members want to walk every street in Madison. WPR's Alyssa Allemand recently took a stroll with the group on the city's east side near the Yahara River.
The COVID-19 lockdown in 2020 led many people to discover the sacredness of a neighborhood stroll. Melinda Morang took that a step further.
Well, I first came up with the idea to walk all of the streets in town during the pandemic, when I was tired of walking all of the same streets over and over again in my neighborhood. And I decided, since I wasn't, you know, traveling, I wasn't really going anywhere, that I should start exploring deep instead of exploring wide.
This all started when she was living in California.
And then when I moved to Madison, I thought that it'd be a really great way to explore the city and learn more about this new city that I'm living in, and also to make friends, because, you know, I don't really know anybody here.
So she started the Madison Methodical Meanderers.
So I would say, like, as far as the goal of literally walking every street in Madison, that's mostly me. I'm the weirdo that really wants to do that, and other people are like, I'll go with you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't really care if I do or don't.
About 2 to 6 people meet up to walk once a week. The group explores a different area of the city each time, with Meringue mapping the 3 to 5 mile routes. Meringue has a special interest in this endeavor that goes beyond walking as just a hobby or exercise.
I make mapping software for a living, so this type of mapping exercise is something that I really enjoy nerding out over.
She follows the route through a tracking app on her phone.
I mean, using my company software for this project is kind of like using an aircraft carrier to go for a lazy afternoon boat ride on Lake Monona, but it's what I have, so, yeah. All right, this little road segment will be a boop, so we're just gonna go to the end and come back. Boops are optional. We have this thing we call a boop, which is when we go to the end of a street and we go boop, and then we turn around and we come back. Because, like, if we want to literally walk every street, sometimes you have to backtrack.
Highlights of the walks often include animals.
That must be mom.
The micro bunny. We love seeing bunnies and turkeys. So if you ever see a pet in a window, point it out. Oh, what was it?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Bopping and window pets. I don't know. What other terms do we have around here?
So there's these geese that swim up and down the river, like, every day. And yesterday they were having flying lessons, and it was really cute.
Cool.
They were like, flap, 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 flap.
The group also points out finds like maker stamps pressed into the sidewalks.
So that one says 2025 because it's brand new. But sometimes you can, like, tell the age of a neighborhood by finding the maker stamp on the sidewalk outside the houses.
I'm learning so much already.
So another thing we do is we always read plaques whenever we find plaques. And we like to read them dramatically. So, W.D. Curtis Mayer, John F. Icky. Really?
Do you have, like, a favorite area of town that you, like, find yourself coming back to? Or?
I mean, of course I love these, like, beautiful old historic neighborhoods that have beautiful gardens and lake views and all that. But really, I can't think when I've ever been on a walk that I didn't find something enjoyable about, like, even the awful ones. Mm-hmm. You know, I always find something that is interesting to look at, or you see a pretty garden, or you see a fun pet, or read an interesting plaque, or you just, like, see the way that the city's constructed, and I just find that fascinating. So
Meringue says she's walked about a quarter of Madison's streets as of the summer of 2025. She predicts it will take the group about 8 years to finish all of them.
WPR's Alyssa Allemand brought us that story on the Madison Methodical Meanderers. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowland Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. And find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
This is WPR News.
A DePaul University finance professor recently completed a 1,000-mile bike ride around Lake Michigan.
He carried his camping gear on his back, documented his ups and downs through social media posts, and raised thousands of dollars for the Michigan Credit Union Foundation.
And Lamont Black joins us now to talk about his ride and how it's changed him. Lamont, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Kate. It's great to be here.
How did you hatch this idea for such a long ride?
So it's not exactly my first rodeo. I did a long bike ride last summer down the Pacific coast from Portland to San Francisco for my 50th birthday. And just sort of had such a great experience that I thought I would do another one. And given that I live here in the Midwest in Chicago, decided to do the ride around Lake Michigan. And just one thing led to another, and it actually came about.
And, you know, full disclosure here, we've usually tapped your cryptocurrency expertise in the past. Is the bike ride at all connected to your work in the tech world?
It is somewhat. So I do a lot of work with the credit union industry around technology, both crypto, stablecoins, and AI. And so this was also a fundraiser for the Michigan Credit Union Foundation. And a lot of the credit unions I work with participated in that. So it was a really cool opportunity to connect those different parts of my life.
You rode over 100 miles a day. What was one of the most challenging parts of the ride?
Yeah, so it was about 1,000 miles to get around the lake, and I did it in 8 days. And so if you take 1,000 divided by 8, that's 125 miles a day. And that's a long stretch for me. So that ride I did in California last summer, I did one day over 100 miles. So this was really stretching my comfort zone. There were moments before I left that I was seriously questioning, you know, whether this was going to be feasible. Mm-hmm. I would say like the first 2 days were really tough. You know, I did it clockwise. So I rode north out of my home here in Chicago. First day, got up through Milwaukee, camped at a state campground, Harris Beach, just north of there. And then second day, rode up through Green Bay into northern Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. And those first 2 days were some of the most challenging because my body was just not accustomed to this. You know, I'd been doing a lot of training. It's not like I just decided to jump on my bike one day. You know, I did a half Ironman this summer.
Wow.
So I had been doing a lot of biking. You know, I don't want to give any misconception there, but not at this type of distance. And so especially like day two, my body was like, wait, we're doing this all over again.
Body didn't get the memo.
No. But the thing I loved, which was what I was really hoping for, is like by day four, day five, I was, you know, your body is, I just feel like our bodies are such amazing, you know, organisms that they can really, they're so adaptive. And so my body did start to adjust and things did get easier. Day four, I was just cranking, just felt super powerful. Day five was one of my other hardest days, but that was because of the weather. Mm. That was when I was up in the Pinky of Michigan, Leelanau, north of Traverse City. And it just rained all day. Major storm front came through. The wind was in my face. And so I was just getting soaked. And it was so hard. I mean, if anybody's ever biked straight into the wind, they know, like, it just makes everything 10 times harder. So, that was a tough day.
We're talking with Lamont Black. He recently completed a more than 1,000-mile bike ride around Lake Michigan. Lamont, Wisconsin, having over 400 miles of Lake Michigan shoreline, what did you see along the way? What were your views like?
Yeah, Wisconsin's a beautiful state. You know, I especially as I was heading into Milwaukee, I went right downtown, you know, right by the art museum there with that iconic building. That was super special. My wife and I have spent a bunch of time in Milwaukee. That's kind of our getaway from Chicago. And so that was really special for me to return there on my bike. And Milwaukee has some amazing bike trails, especially as you get north of downtown. So that was really nice. But I would say actually my favorite part of riding through Wisconsin was not so much the shoreline as just the country roads. Mm. Like that section between Milwaukee and Green Bay, you know, there's not a ton out there, and which was really special for me because some of those country roads where you're out on the fields and, you know, you're going by different farmhouses and then the beautiful old barns, you know, yeah. Some of them, you know, just so meticulously cared for and still in those, some of them in those bright red colors, riding by, you know, herds of milk cows and just that to me, that pastoral feeling of, you know, the old countryside is the way it used to be. That was really special.
Oh, I appreciate those images. I'm wondering about resting your head at night. I was following your social, and I know at one point you had to do a bike in campsite. I believe it was in Wisconsin where it was difficult to get a normal campsite. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. So that was my first night north of Milwaukee, Harris Beach State Park. And one thing that's I love about the state parks, including Wisconsin, is that, so Wisconsin has a policy that if you're traveling by your own power, whether that's by bike or as a backpacker, that they will find a place to put you up. And that state park, like I think many of them, has a special site set aside for bikepackers like myself. And so I didn't have an advance reservation. It's walk-in only. But they were able to put me up there. So I had a nice campsite all to myself. The one surprise that I did not fully anticipate was the mosquitoes. That night,
they were uninvited
I showed
on
this ride. No, man, I got there. You know, I just biked 125 miles. I was so tired. And I thought, finally, you know, I could sit down and rest my head. And as soon as I plopped down on that picnic table, it was like the buzzing just started all around my head. So, yeah, I travel with a little one-person tent. I threw that up as quickly as I could and got inside. I had to kill off some of the extra mosquitoes that followed me in. It's, you know, like they say, when you're out there in the woods or doing these types of things, like the food never tasted so good. And then also, you know, sleeping at night. Like as soon as I put my head on my little inflatable pillow and I laid down on my inflatable mattress, I was out pretty quick.
Has this ride changed how you go about your days now?
It has. That's a great question. You know, for me, this type of ride is partly about the adventure. You know, I just, there's, you know, a temptation for us, all of us, I think, to just start to get into our comfort zone. You know, we go to work, we come home, we do something fun on the weekend, and then, you know, rinse and repeat. And I really love that idea of getting out there into the great wide open, exposing myself to the elements, you know, and taking on those big challenges. And the thing that has really, that this ride in particular impacted for me was setting the goal, achieving that goal, getting through those hard days, and knowing now that I can do it, that, you know, even when I face hard times, I can persist. And when I get knocked down, I can get back up. And so I now bring that into work, into family and friendship. You know, I still get discouraged and disappointed based on setbacks, just like everyone else. But even over the last couple of months, I've noticed that I've got a little bit more resilience. I've got, you know, just a slightly stronger fortitude to manage those different ups and downs. And as I think about my personal dreams and ambitions, you know, as you mentioned, I've got my own company now with speaking and consulting. And I just, I'm going to keep growing and building and pursuing because, you know, if I can do a 1,000-mile bike ride, what else can I do? And so it just kind of sets that fire in my bones and just gets me excited about where I can go from here.
Lamont, thank you for sharing your adventure with us and happy trails.
Thank you very much, Kate. I'll see you out there on the road.
That is Lamont Black, Associate Professor of Finance at DePaul University in Chicago. He's also the CEO of a consulting firm called Wide Open Ventures. And he told us about his recent 8-day solo bike ride around Lake Michigan.
Last week, we previewed a documentary about Green Bay Packers fans from Japan.
And we heard a listener story about encountering Welsh fans of the team. And here's another international Packers story emailed by a listener named Tim.
Tim writes, "That reminded me of the time I went to Playa del Carmen in Mexico. It was 2005. My dad was wearing his everyday Packers hat as we walked the streets. We came across a man yelling excitedly about Green Bay Packers and Brett Favre, and my dad stopped to talk football for a bit. After they talked ball, the guy tried to sell us on a timeshare package and a free fishing trip to listen to the sales pitch. So I don't know if he was just really good at American culture for his job or he was a true fan. Either way, it was a great experience and a funny story."
Thanks so much, Tim. Keep sharing your stories about running into Packers fans from all around the world. Email WisconsinToday at WPR.org or call or text us at 888-642-0232.
Wisconsin Today producers include Royce Podeswa, Rochelle Wilson, and Avery Lee Rogers.
Our technical directors are Sarah Hopeful and Lee Rayburn. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Thanks for listening to WPR News.